Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today looks at how talk radio, reality TV, and cable news perpetuate an endless cycle of mistrust and hate that degrades the social institutions we depend on, all with an eye to the bottom line. Eric Deggans is NPR's first full-time TV critic. He came to NPR from the Tampa Bay Times newspaper in Florida and is an adjunct professor at Duke University. He serves as a media analyst at MSNBC, NBC News. Eric Deggans is author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. It's a look at how prejudice, racism, and sexism fuel some elements of modern media. Eric Deggans, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I'd like to begin, if you have your book handy.
I do.
Good. Would you please read the first page of your introduction?
Sure. It's called Making All the Right Enemies. The first and only time I met Fox News Channel star Bill O'Reilly, he looked at me like I owed him money. The situation was, I will admit, an uncomfortable one. He and a publicity executive at Fox News had already turned down an interview request for this very book, despite the fact that he inspired the title. And though he planned several stops around my St. Petersburg, Florida home base to tout his own new book in early 2012, sharing a cup of joe with me was not particularly high on his to-do list. That's because we have, as a therapist might say, a bit of history. At various times on his top-rated evening cable cast, O'Reilly has called me, quote, dishonest, quote, racially motivated, and, quote, one of the biggest race baiters in the country for criticizing the way he talks about race on his program. So as I plan this tome on how race issues and prejudice play out in media, I wanted to talk with O'Reilly, and he didn't want to talk with me. Fair enough. But when the top-rated anchor came to give a speech in nearby Sarasota, organizers emailed me an invitation to a small press conference he was holding before the event. We have history, I warned. He probably won't be happy to see me there. Sure enough, when we gathered in a small green room area deep inside the bowels of the Van Wezel Hall, tight smiles were the order of the day. Two reporters from local papers and two high school students flanked me at a small round table where O'Reilly was going to field questions. After talking with the anchor about my presence, the president of the group presenting the lecture series had one question. Quote, will you be civil?
And you replied, of course, as long as he
is. Of course, I'm a professional. Yes.
And I was a little bit amused, Eric, at later on, a few pages further into your book, you explain that you were called a race baiter, but how did you feel about that?
Oh, well, you know, by that point, I had been writing about race and media a while. And by that point, I had tangled with O'Reilly in a few different settings. So I understood the tactic, which is to, number one, accuse your opponent of whatever it is you're actually doing. So that's the first thing he does. But the other thing is to try to redefine terms that are damaging to the arguments you're trying to make. So in his case, he's trying to redefine the term race baiter and use it to refer to people who want to talk about problems with racism and prejudice, because he doesn't believe that systemic racism is a problem in America. And in fact, most of the pundits on Fox News Channel don't believe that. And that is one of the overriding ethics of that operation. And so in order to press that agenda, he needs to redefine the term race baiter from what it used to mean, which is it was a term that was used to describe politicians and public thinkers who would try to whip up the racial fears of white people in order to press these agendas that were about segregation and about oppressing people of color. He wanted to change the definition of the term from that to something that would be used to discourage people who wanted to talk about systemic racism in society in a way that he didn't agree with.
In fact, you write in your book, I've often written that journalists should be judged by the enemies they make and the epithets they are called. So in this case, Being called a race baiter by the biggest star at a cable news channel has turned racially insensitive talk into a viewership strategy feels much less like an insult. Actually, it feels like a compliment. So there's exactly. The title of your book.
Exactly. And in fact, the way I came up with the idea to actually use it as a title was that I was telling this story about Bill O'Reilly delivering this, one of his talking points memo commentaries on his show. And where he called me one of the biggest race baiters in the country. And my friend said, oh, you got to call your book Race Baiter. I mean, you just have to. And so I said, after thinking about it for a while, I was like, yeah, you're right. I'm seeking to redefine the term, and I'm seeking to reclaim it from people who would try to use it in a manner that I don't think it was originally coined or intended for. So I'll slap that title on the book and try to redefine it.
Well, you say in your book that it's an attempt to decode the ways media outlets profit by segmenting Americans. And so you have a nice description of pretty much what you're attempting to do with this book. And this is on page 13 in your book, Eric. Would you read that?
Sure. Let's see. As digital technology nibbles away at big media's dominance, many outlets have responded by amplifying the divisions that separate Americans by race, class, gender, sexual orientation, and location. The ongoing fragmentation of media with Facebook, Twitter, iPods, YouTube sites, and internet-accessible smartphones allowing users to create their own custom-tailored media worlds has only made it all worse. And the audience has had few guides for cutting through the clutter. Until now. This book is an attempt to decode the ways media outlets profit by segmenting Americans. I call it the tyranny of the broad niche. What happens as the biggest pieces of an increasingly fragmented audience are courted at the expense of many others? At a time when singular figures like Barack Obama, Sarah Palin, Hillary Clinton, Ellen DeGeneres, and Oprah Winfrey are shattering cultural and gender boundaries, the media establishment is too often scurrying behind public sentiment. There may be only one cure for this increasing balkanization, changing the audience itself. It's time to build a more savvy crowd that demands more from its media products and rejects the tactics of division. Judging by the feedback I've gotten from readers, Twitter followers, and Facebook friends, there's a hunger for more even-handed material and some guidance for sorting the news from the noise. For some, this message doesn't seem so important. Particularly if your culture is one of the broad niches used as a target audience, it can feel like media outlets are simply working harder to tell it like it is, relating news and perspectives that feel correct because they're more closely tailored to your tastes and outlook than ever before. Comic Stephen Colbert calls this phenomenon truthiness, or the certainty of following your feelings and emotion over actual facts. But for a look at the other side of that coin, I often describe an old print advertisement published in some black-focused magazines in the 1970s, showing a young black boy with a towel pinned on his back, looking into a mirror and imagining himself as the world's greatest superhero. The jarring twist, the heroic face that looked back at him from the mirror, belongs to a white man. The problem with super serving the biggest niches is that those whose culture and background don't fit those spaces wind up further marginalized. Just ask the French government, which saw vicious riots tear through its ghettoized suburbs in 2005, as disenfranchised, unemployed, and disaffected youth banded together in a massive display of civil unrest. When people feel they no longer have a stake or influence in the wider society, they have nothing to lose.
This is NPR journalist Eric Deggans reading from Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. And when I started reading your book, Eric, I thought, wow, this guy is so insightful. And then it was after I started reading your book that I looked at the blurb on the back by Michelle Norris, who host of NPR's All Things Considered. And she says, Eric Deggans proved that he is one of the most insightful and courageous writers covering today's fast-shifting media landscape. This is an important book. And I thought, as I was reading too, I thought, God, this guy is so insightful, but also prescient.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. in my work at Duke University, what I wound up doing, I was teaching a class on race and media. And one of the reasons I wrote this book was because I was working as an adjunct at other colleges, University of Tampa and Eckerd College. And I couldn't find one book that pulled together all the ideas I wanted to talk about regarding race and media. And so I would have to, you know, send the kids, you know, a couple of links to different stories, and I have to make copies of chapters from two or three different books. And, you know, we had this weird melange of material, and I just decided, you know, it would be nice to bring it all together in a book so that if anybody wanted to teach this course, it would all be in one book. And so then Duke University came to me and said, well, you know, go ahead and teach that course now. So in January, you know, I started teaching this course that was based around the book. And I thought the course would be a good way to sort of inspire some early work to update what's in it. As I and the students sort of combed through the stuff that was in its pages, which, you know, was published in 2012, you know, we could update stuff, and then I'd have a blueprint for how to, you know, suggest a follow-up book. You know, this was, I'm working on all cylinders here, right? And so to my surprise, when we started digging into the material in class, there wasn't that much to update because the things that I describe are just happening even more so in media. The racism and the anti-Black sentiments of pundits in Fox News's prime time has only gotten worse. Instead of Bill O'Reilly and Megyn Kelly, who could be obvious sometimes in expressing those sentiments, but often used code words or often, you know, didn't directly say things or might surprise you sometimes with some of the things they would say. You know, Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham have straight up said things that are completely racist, including saying that diversity is not America's strength, which I think is not only insulting and racist, it's not true. America's diversity is entirely its strength. And so these dynamics have just gotten worse for the most part. There's some stuff in the book about a lack of diversity in scripted television, and I think, you know, there's been great strides made in that area. Network television is a lot more diverse than it was when this book came out, and cable television and streaming also. So that's one place that has made a lot of great strides. And, you know, this book came out before podcasting really was much of anything. So I spend way too much time talking about AM talk people and terrestrial radio and Air America, that failed attempt at creating a liberal terrestrial radio network. Instead of realizing that what would happen is those voices, those liberal voices in particular, would move to podcasting. And that's where they live now, especially the ones that reach young people. So there's some parts of it that could use some updating, but it is depressing to realize how consistent and how steady the drumbeat of systemic racism and prejudice is in American society and in modern media. And I feel like this moment is great. People are actually trying to address it. And some people seem really committed in trying to change things. But, you know, I've been talking about this stuff for 20 years, and it hasn't changed significantly enough that my book that came out in 2012 pretty much describes what's happening now.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll continue my conversation with author and journalist Eric Deggans, author of Race Baiter. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Weekman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, NPR journalist Eric Deggans. Another thought as I was reading your book, Eric, was pretty much what you were just saying. As I was reading, I thought, why hadn't somebody written this book before? And you were just saying you had to do your research for your class because it hadn't been written before.
Well, you know, I mean, part of it is that, frankly, there are not that many non-white people who write about media in America. I am probably the longest tenured Black TV critic in the country. And I'm one of a handful of Black people who regularly write about media. And I can't think of anybody else who sort of goes back and forth between sort of covering the more, providing the more traditional kind of media coverage where I, you know, report on, you know, who owns a company. I report on, you know, how diverse their staff might be or how diverse their board might be, you know, kind of traditional media coverage. And then also the kind of opinionated criticism that a TV critic does. There are not that many people who straddle that line the way I do, you know. So I think that's part of it is that, you know, there's hardly anybody else in the country who looks at media the way I do and straddles as many different types of reporting on media as I do.
Well, you say that...
You know, I'm sorry. I was distracted because I felt like the last answer I gave was a little incomplete. When I say I'm the only person, I mean I'm the only non-white person doing a lot of this. Not the only, but one of the few non-white people doing this stuff. And when you're a person of color and your job is to decode media, one of the things I'm always trying to do is figure out what white people think about things. And so it gives me a sense because, you know, the white people are the largest part of my audience because I write for I write and talk for mainstream media outlets. So I'm constantly seeing the difference between how people of color are treated and how white people are treated. What messaging is created to reach the biggest audience, which is usually mostly white people, and who that leaves behind. How characters are presented to the audience and what kind of stereotypes they feed into or they subvert. So, you know, I feel like I'm able to sort of see that wide range of things because I'm a person of color who is coming to media structures that are generally oriented towards white people. So I just wanted to make that clear that there are a lot of people who write about media. There are not that many non-white people who write about media and TV criticism the way I do.
Well, you state that media's role, the role of the news media in American society, is to be an aggressive watchdog of government, a voice for the average person without wealth or power, and a check on the influence and authority of major institutions such as big corporations in an effort to ensure equal treatment for everyone.
And, you know, what I was trying to get at was... that people, because there is this attempt to cast everything in ideological terms, particularly by this giant alternative media structure that has been built to favor conservative pundits and conservative thought and conservative politicians. This media structure includes Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and the Wall Street Journal editorial page and the Daily Caller and, you know, a bunch of other outlets. So there's this drive to sort of make everything, cast everything in ideological terms. And of course, one of the things that happens a lot is that people look at mainstream media outlets and what they do and they judge it ideologically. You know, CNN is covering Corona, so they must be doing this to embarrass the president. MSNBC is interested in the attacks on Obamacare, so they, you know, they must be trying to oppose the GOP in their efforts to end Obamacare. NPR is focused on talking about, abortion rights, or talking about how prejudice works in media, so they, you know, they must be liberal. And I feel like when you're talking about most mainstream media outlets, first of all, their biases are much more aligned towards economic biases. They need to generate revenue. They want to build audience. They want to dominate coverage in a way that people see them as an authority. They often want to be they want to get the biggest celebrities. They want to have the highest profile reporting. They want impact. None of those things are necessarily connected to ideology. The actual political ideology, I would argue, is much further down on the spectrum than a lot of people are willing to admit or realize. On top of that, we have journalistic imperatives. We have journalistic values. Part of accuracy, for example, is diversity. If you go out and you report a story about the protests in the wake of George Floyd's death, and you don't accurately and completely talk to the people of color who are on the streets trying to press for change, in addition to talking to police and city officials and, you know, the traditional sources that are much easier for journalists to reach, then you won't have the complete story. And so to some people, pressing for diversity may feel like some sort of liberal some sort of liberal ideology in action. But what it really is about is accuracy, making sure that a wide diversity of reporters and editors and journalists are out in the field or working at that news outlet to create the reports that people consume so that they reflect the wide variety of people who are part of our community. Also, to make sure that we talk to a wide variety of people in our community and make sure they're fully represented in our news reporting. That just makes the stories accurate. So I think some of the time, the values that journalists pursue feel like liberal ideology to people who are conservative. And I would just say there's another way to think about that, that is actually what most journalists in mainstream news outlets believe they're doing. And if you want to understand what we're doing or why we're making the choices we make, you have to try to see it that way, even if you don't agree. And that's the weird thing about media, because everybody consumes media, because everybody has media as such an intimate part of their lives. They think they understand it and they think they know it, but they don't really. Particularly if you haven't worked at a news outlet, particularly if you haven't spent time studying how media works. If all you've done is watch TV and read stories on the internet, you don't know how media works. You really don't. And you need to take some time to read books like mine and many others, you know, read some Jeff Jarvis, you know, subscribe to the Reliable Sources newsletter and check out, you know, what they're doing over there, Oliver Darcy and Brian Stelter. Educate yourself a little bit more on what's actually happening rather than making assumptions based on, you know, ideological assumptions about what people are doing.
My guest is NPR journalist Eric Deggans. His book is Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. And I was interested in the steps that you describe the journalism process as three steps. And you bring these up because there was a case where the videos seemed to have left out three very important steps in the journalism process. And this is your chapter two, Information Wars. Would you tell us what you feel are these three important steps in the journalism process?
Okay. You're gonna wind up stumping me here because I haven't read that chapter in a while. This is where I was talking about the Acorn videos. Is that it?
Well, one reason that I was particularly fascinated with these steps is what happened to Al Franken? I don't know how familiar you are with what happened to him, but as I was reading these three steps, I thought, oh my gosh, these steps were not followed when they reported accusing Al Franken of something that, well, why don't I let you go ahead and tell us what?
Sure, sure. And, you know, I mean, the issue with Al Franken is he decided to resign. I mean, you know, if he, you know, whether or not he might have been guilty of chapter and verse of what he was accused of, I think it was kind of obvious in the photos that he was doing things that were not particularly respectful to some of the women he was dealing with. But
more to the story, and even his colleagues who gave him the thumbs down afterwards said they really regretted it, because one of these steps, step three, give the subject of the story a chance to respond before making it public.
Well, that's in the case of journalism reporting. If someone has, if some private citizen has made something public, the journalist can't do anything about that. You have to find out whatever you can about what they've made public, and then you try to go to the person that it's about and you get their side. And that's what happened in Al Franken's case, because the person who released, these photos was not a journalist working on a story. It was the person who was depicted in the photos. I am not as familiar with that case as I should be. I'm not comfortable debating the details of it, I would say that I agree with you. It is complex, but it's complex in a way that doesn't necessarily exonerate him. And he chose to resign ultimately. So that's the deal.
Is that this woman who made the accusation was egged on by people who had an interest in embarrassing Al Franken.
Sure, but it wasn't just her. There were other women who made allegations. But at any rate, I'm at the point in the book that you're talking about. And so I was writing about these videos that this person who claims to be a conservative investigative journalist, James O'Keefe, had made where he and a helper, a friend, an aide, I don't know, had gone into one of the offices of this group called Acorn. And they claim that they came to these offices. They told people in the office that he was a pimp, who was looking for a way to sort of create tax shelters to hide his income and things like that. And he had a woman with him that he claimed was, one of his sex workers. And he claimed that the people at Acorn, which is this group that was formed to, you know, they did a lot of voter registration drives for Democratic candidates and things like that, that they gave him advice on what to do without acknowledging that, you know, he was a criminal asking for advice to further a crime. And you know, they should have called the cops. So once you examine the videos and you found out a little bit of the backstory, you realize that he provided these videos. I think they were shown on Fox. They were shown on Fox News, I do believe. And when he went on Fox News to show the videos, he was dressed in this sort of flamboyant outfit that was sort of the caricature of what a pimp would look like. You know, a flamboyant hat, and I think he was wearing some kind of cape. He had a cane or something like that. And he had pictures of himself like that in the videos. But when you talk to the workers who had actually talked to him, he was not dressed like that. So there's some question about how he presented himself to the Acorn workers and whether he was being fully honest about what he said to them in order to get them to say back to him the things that he included in the video. And the state of California did an exhaustive investigation and then sort of analyze what they thought had happened at the Acorn sites that were inside the state of California. And when I read that report, I realized there were a few things that could give you a clue as to whether or not you're seeing actual journalism or whether you're seeing propaganda and ideology that's framed like journalism. And the first thing was that they didn't fully characterize their own actions. You know, documentarians, for example, are supposed to, if they set up a shot or if they go visit someone at their workplace, they're supposed to be fully transparent about how they approach that person and what they say to that person and then how the conversation went. You know, so having a situation where James O'Keefe implies that he was dressed a certain way when he wasn't dressed that way when he talked to those people, it just makes you doubt whether he is accurately conveying the details of how he approached these people and what he said to them. He didn't fully characterize the actions of the people that he videotaped. That's the second step because, you know, one worker listened to his story about supposedly being a pimp wanting these things and kind of played along with him, gathered down all his information, and then called the cops, which was, you know, what you would expect them to do. But you know, James O'Keefe sort of presented the videos as if to suggest that they didn't really do that. So he wasn't being fair to everyone that he wasn't being fair to all the people that he approached in this video sting because some people responded the way that you would expect them to, and he didn't acknowledge that. And then he didn't give the subjects of the story a chance to respond before it was published. So if generally, if you're a journalist and you're going to create a story that's going to make allegations about an institution or about a person that are negative, you want to approach that institution or person and tell them what you've learned and how you know it, and then give them a chance to respond, give them a chance to explain. And even if the explanation may be insufficient, at least you gave them a chance to say, well, you know, what happened was this. And it might be understandable. You know, you really don't know unless you go to them and you and you tell them what you have, and then you give them a chance to explain. So if you take a story like this with a bunch of allegations and you don't contact the people that it's about before it airs, then it seems like your goal really isn't to find out what was actually going on. Your goal is to embarrass the organization and get a negative story about them out into the news mix before they have a chance to actually respond to it. And so those are three questions that you could actually apply to a lot of news stories that you see as a way to give you a sense about whether it was fairly constructed. You know, is the person who created the story fully transparent about what they did to report the story? Are they fully and fairly characterizing the actions of the people who they are describing in the story? And did they give the subjects of the story a chance to respond before publishing their story? And if you look at, you know, well done Pulitzer Prize winning news efforts, you will find that they fit those three elements very well.
After a break, I'll be back with journalist and author Eric Deggans, who has written a book, Race Baiter: How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, author and journalist Eric Deggans, who has written about how the media wields dangerous words to divide our nation. And kind of along those lines, Eric, there was a story, and I'm sure you remembered, about this little boy, this little black boy. They were talking to him, and the little boy said he wants a gun. And they cut him off. They didn't give him a chance to continue that. What happened in that case?
So this was a situation where I think the person who recorded this was a freelance reporter. And, you know, in a lot of cities, there are sort of these networks of freelance people who have cameras who can run to emergency situations and get interviews and get tape of something before someone who's on staff could actually get there. You know, here where I live in Florida, there are people, they tend to chase, you know, car accidents and things like that because we don't have as many murders. But in Chicago, you know, they chase drive-by shootings. So this person goes to a situation where there was a particularly bad shooting and is talking to a young kid who's out on the street and asks him, you know, what he thinks about what's going on. And the kid says, you know, he's gonna get himself a gun. Now, when the story was created for the TV station in Chicago, I think it was WBBM, the CBS affiliate, they just had the kid saying, I'm gonna get a gun, a young black kid saying, I'm gonna get a gun. And of course the anchor sort of said, oh, you know, that's how bad things are and I can't believe they want to do that. Well, if you see the raw video and give it just a few more minutes, the kid says, I'm gonna get a gun, and then the guy asks, well, why would you wanna get a gun? He says, I'm gonna be the police. So he wanted to become a police officer so that he could protect his neighborhood, as opposed to this implication that he wanted to get a gun and maybe join in the shootouts that were ravaging his neighborhood. And, you know, it's just an example of how, you know, a small editorial, what seems like a small editorial choice, can either subvert a prejudice or a stereotype about someone, or it can reinforce it. And so if you want to believe that the young black people in Chicago who are involved in drive-by shootings and such are conditioned to be that way from when they're very young, and, you know, are these super predators, you know, in the making, even when they're 8 or 9 or 10 years old, then the way he cut that quote will speak to and confirm, you know, your prejudices and your unfair assumptions about the children who live in those neighborhoods. But if he would have included the full quote, then you would have had a quote that sort of cut against what people expected, and would have shown, hey, you know, kids who are in the middle of these dangerous neighborhoods, they want to become police officers so that they can stop it, so that they can enforce the law. But that goes counter to a lot of the stereotypes that people have about young people who live in those neighborhoods. And so that's why journalists have to be careful. And that's why journalism is such a tough job, because you can cut out half of a sentence and you can go from creating a story that subverts stereotypes and is something that's journalistically admirable to creating a story that encourages stereotypes and that's completely inaccurate.
My guest is NPR journalist Eric Deggans. His book is Race Baiter. And you were talking about these biases that we have, but we don't realize we're biased. If you ask me, well, Eric, I'm not biased. But you make a point in your book that we are not conscious of these biases. So what can we do about this?
Well, I think we have to learn to accept things that seem to be true. And things that are borne out by lots of scientific studies and polling and the work of very talented academics. I'm not just saying this because I believe it to be true. There are a ton of footnotes in my book. you know, every chapter has, you know, 40 or 50, you know, footnotes, up to 80 footnotes. So I tried really hard to find studies or polls or other journalism that backed up the things that I thought was happening, one of the things that we have to accept is that all of us, no matter what our race, no matter what our ethnicity, no matter what our cultural background, if you live in America, and particularly if you've grown up in America, you have been raised in a society that elevates white culture and white people over other kinds of people. And it is something that is embedded in the fabric of the country. It's in our political system. It's in our educational system. You know, people ask, well, why didn't we know what Juneteenth was? Why hadn't we heard about the Tulsa massacre? Why don't we know about civil rights leaders in the 1960s beyond Martin Luther King and Malcolm X? You know, because of the system that we've grown up in, where certain people are valued and certain people are slightly less valued or a lot less valued. So once you understand that and you kind of accept that, then you can look at the different areas of life and you can get an inkling. You can see how television or movies or education or housing or employment, you can see how it's geared towards elevating white people over other kinds of people. And then you can get a sense of how you can arrest those thoughts inside yourself, or at least become aware of that reflex and stop yourself from indulging it or figure out a way to subvert it. I have a fair number of businesses coming to me now and saying, you know, there's all this talk about, you know, systemic racism, and we want to do what we can to fight it. You know, what can we do? And, you know, my response is always, if you take 10 minutes and think about your organization, I will guarantee you already know what you need to do. But whether or not you are willing to do it, that's the question. So, you know, if you have a business and almost all of your leaders are white people, well, then you know what you got to do to unwind systemic racism in your company. You've got to get more diversity in your leadership, and you got to figure out why it's taking this long for you to do it in the first place. So I feel very strongly that for a lot of people, if they spend like 5 or 10 minutes thinking about these issues, they'll uncover the areas in their life where this is going on, but you've just kind of avoided thinking about it, or you've just accepted that that's the way it is, or you just have thought, well, there's no harm in this, but there really is.
Well, you have a quote from somebody else in your book: people can carry out biases they're not aware they have. Asking people to recognize having an unconscious bias, it's almost impossible to get people to do that. It takes a long period of reflection and dialogue to do that.
It does. You know, one thing that I've said quite often is that the great strength of white supremacy in America is that white racial culture is invisible. It is not talked about directly in the way that Black culture or Latino culture or Asian American culture is talked about. And that lends it a power because it is able to affect all these areas of life, but it's not recognized as such. And I feel like white people in particular, because you don't have to know how race works in America in order to have a successful life, you don't talk about those things. Certainly not as much as people of color have to talk about these things, because we have to understand how this works in order to succeed. If we want to work at a major corporation that's run by white people, we have to understand how race works in that organization, or we're not going to prosper. You know, Bubba Wallace has to understand how the white drivers around him connect to each other and support each other and build friendships with each other. Otherwise, he'll never be able to succeed in the world of NASCAR. It's what we call code switching, where you might have been raised under one kind of culture with a way of communicating and an outlook on life. But if you're in a situation where you're surrounded by people who are from another culture, you have to learn how to connect to them. You have to learn how to communicate with them. So you have to learn their culture. But because white people are often never in situations where they're outnumbered by people from another race or another culture, they often don't have to do that. And so what's difficult is getting people to understand that and accept that and then take the steps that it takes to learn how to see things a different way. And often what that means is getting close to people who are from cultures that are different than yours and deliberately putting yourself in situations where your culture is not the dominant culture in the room so you can understand what it feels like.
You know, Eric, one of the sentences that I thought in your book was prescient. You say, we are accustomed to talking about race only when there is a crisis. Someone is dead. Someone is unfairly jailed. Someone is in need. And injustice looms. And in view of what's happened recently, that helps explain how upset people are over recent events. That you say, we don't talk about race unless there's a crisis when somebody is dead.
Right. Well, you know, the thing that's sad about this situation, and I hate to be so cynical about it, but it's a cynicism that's born of experience. And I hate to generalize in this way, but I really think it's true. I think great numbers of white people don't care about race until something happens that shakes them out of their apathy. And in this case, it was the death of George Floyd that was captured on tape in a way that showed that it was completely unfair and that the police officers who were doing it to him didn't seem like they cared all that much that he was dying. So that was jarring enough that it kind of woke people up and it got them interested in learning about these issues and it sparked all this conversation and, you know, people are wanting reading lists and they're wanting movies and, you know, all of this stuff. And those of us who have been talking about this and talking about this and talking about this regularly, you know, we've seen this movie, you know. People get very excited for a week or two or for a month. But what happens 2 months from now? What happens 3 months from now? Because this kind of change takes a long time to figure out. And so what happens to that energy and that drive and that wanting to learn about it? And the other problem is that when something happens like this that's so jarring, it's also very polarizing. So just as you have all these people who are galvanized to say this is unfair and the police department needs to be dismantled and what can we do about systemic racism and policing, you have a whole other group that says, hey, wait a minute, I don't want to lose my police department. This is going too far. You know, people are going to create a situation where there's no laws and people are running around doing what they want. And it is hard to have the kind of open-hearted conversation that's required to understand another person's culture and another person's point of view. You have to be willing to open yourself up in a way that's tough to do when you're polarized and you're fighting each other. So this is, in a lot of ways, the exact wrong moment to try and have these discussions. But because so many people are apathetic about the issue until something shakes them awake, that's the only time we have these discussions. And so, you know, I'm constantly saying, in some way or shape or form, okay, look, this is not the best time to have this conversation, but since everybody's paying attention, here's what's going on. And so I've been doing that for the last, you know, 3 weeks or so. And I can already feel that people are getting weary. Their attention is starting to turn. The top 10 list on Netflix is turning away from movies and TV shows that were created by black people. And I can already feel that people are getting weary of this conversation. But again, when you're a person of color who lives in America, you can't get weary of this because it's your life. It's your kid's life. It's your family's life.
Well, before we wrap up, Eric, I would like to mention a part of your book. You say that race baiting requires one skill above all others, and that is media literacy. And I was struck by the fact that you, it happens that you and I both attended Indiana University, and we were we were in different disciplines, but there was one huge figure that overlapped our disciplines, and that was a activist, social critic Noam Chomsky, who was also a linguist, which was my field. And you say that you still have his book on your mantelpiece today.
Oh yeah, I use it. I teach it when I teach these courses. I teach part of Manufacturing Consent, which is a book he did with a co-author to talk about how the elites control mainstream news media. And, you know, there's parts of it that are a little dated because he wrote it at a time when our biggest overseas or not overseas, our biggest adventures outside of the country were the terrible things we were doing in Latin America. And so he spent a lot of time talking about sort of our hypocritical stances in dealing with, you know, governments in Latin America. But other than that, the book does talk a lot about these things that I sort of alluded to earlier in our talk. You know, he has several different influences that affect mainstream news outlets. And one of the things he talks about is FLAC. If some, you know, organization or people out in the community can figure out how to direct sustained targeted criticism at media outlets, it can be a way to get them to change what they report. You might not stop a particular report from airing, but you can make that news outlet self-conscious about how it's reporting on something and maybe get them to lean a little more towards your side the next time they do a report. They call that working the refs, like they do in sports. So Noam Chomsky has a lot of different things where he talks about, you know, different principles like that, so that you can understand why news media makes the choices that it does.
Well, thank you so much for bringing your insights to us today, Eric. Let me remind listeners, your book is Race Baiter: How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. The author is Eric Dickens.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.